This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Ihis Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Zimbabwe is issuing a new currency known as bond notes that officially equal to the US dollar. The government has gone ahead with the plan despite warnings the new currency will fuel hyperinflation and worsen the already ailing economy.
That's Sebastian Monfu reporting from Harare. Details coming up.
Also mired in a financial scandal for years, South African President Jacob Zuma is fighting for his political life as the ruling African National Congress Party weighs his future. And clashes between the Ugandan military and tribal militants in a remote region of the Rwenzori Mountains claims more than 55 lives.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, South African President Jacob Zuma is fighting for his political life as the ruling African National Congress Party weighs his future. Zuma has been mired in a financial scandal for years and faces investigation on corruption charges relating to the influential Gupta family. Now at least three cabinet ministers have called on President Zuma to resign. Reporter Delia Robertson is following the story. From Johannesburg, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about Mr. Zuma's political battle.
This is a very severe threat to his tenure as president indeed, Joe. It's something that's been building for some time. There's been a growing level of dissatisfaction within the African National Congress with what some people see as his misrule, as his abuse of his office to benefit himself and members of his family and his friends, who most commonly known as the Guptas. So it's just something that has been growing within the organization. And I guess what has finally happened is there was a calculation made that there were enough people who would vote against him at the National Executive Committee meeting to actually ask him to step aside. Whether that prevails or not, we don't know yet, because the meeting has been going on since Saturday. It was supposed to finish yesterday, and it was extended until today, and it's still going on. And I would imagine that there's a great deal of competition within the senior members of the ANC over this matter.
Now, it is interesting that Zuma finds himself in this position when he himself pretty much forced out the previous president, Thabo Mbeki.
Indeed. And, you know, it later turned out that the reasons they gave for Mr. Mbeki's recall at the time was a court judgment in a corruption case against Zuma, funnily enough. And the judge at the time said Mbeki had abused his office. And that ruling was ultimately overturned by the appeal court, who completely pulled it apart on legal grounds.
Delia, how much does this have to do with the African National Congress, the ruling party, trying to repair its image following the last elections and the scandals surrounding President Zuma?
Well, I think it's got everything to do with all of those things, Joe. The longer Zuma has stayed in office, the greater the scandals that have built up around the ANC, around himself and the people who support him. And, of course, this has resonated for the first time amongst the voters in South Africa in the last elections, when the ANC lost three major municipalities, two metros, Johannesburg and Pretoria, to the opposition. And, you know, there had always been a feeling that the ANC would gradually sort of lose support, maybe a bit to the left over a long period of time. But this is happening very quickly. And the consensus among a great many analysts and people who monitor this political situation in South Africa is that the ANC will be very hard-pressed to win a simple majority in the next general election in 2019.
What happens if the ANC at its meeting votes a no-confidence vote for President Zuma, or whatever it's officially called? Would he be required to step down?
Yes, because the ANC would then, to put it in the phrases that they use, they would be redeploying him. Yes, no, they did it to Mbeki, and they can clearly do it to Zuma. Mbeki, when it got to that point, stepped aside, and actually in one of the best acts as leader of this country, really put the country first, and his address to the nation saying he was stepping aside was really quite remarkable. Zuma is fighting tooth and nail to stay in position. If this vote does not go against him, there are further plans afoot, because he can fire cabinet ministers and government officials, but he has no say about members of parliament. They are elected by the party, and there's a feeling that they could then take it to parliament, where, as you know, there have been at least two motions of no confidence in Zuma in the past year. If this attempt to remove him fails, then the understanding is that this group of disaffected ANC members will then go to parliament and table a motion of no confidence. And all they would need in parliament is 50 ANC members to vote with the opposition, and that would spell the end for him.
Let's say this does happen. Who might be the next South African president?
Well, I think at the moment what will clearly happen is that the deputy president, Cyril Ramaphosa, will step in, and that will then put him in a much stronger position to stand as the ANC candidate for president in 2019.
Ramaphosa goes way back to the apartheid days, does he not?
Well, he goes back to the negotiations for the Democratic South Africa. He led the ANC negotiations team at what was known as CODESA at the time, and was the chief architect of South Africa's current constitution.
And how old is Cyril Ramaphosa?
Cyril Ramaphosa is 64 years old, so he has some legs in him politically still.
That's reporter Delia Robertson from Johannesburg. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
More than 55 people have died in clashes between the Ugandan military and tribal militants in a remote region of the Ruwenzori Mountains. A police spokesman says 14 Ugandan officers and 41 rebels are dead from weekend clashes in the western district of Kasisi. That's near the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. The rebels are believed to be followers of Charles Wesley Mumberi, a tribal chief of Uganda's Bakonzo people. He's been a critic of Uganda's longtime president, Yoweri Museveni. The military overwhelmed Mumberi's guards and said they had detained him for his own safety. Followers of Mumberi have been calling for secession from Uganda.
Officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo's North Kivu province say more than 30 civilians are dead after yesterday's attack by the ethnic Nande militia. They told Reuters the militia attacked the village of Luhana with machetes and guns after firing on a nearby army post. The village is predominantly Hutu. The region has suffered long-standing conflict since the Congo government launched a military campaign against the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, or FDLR. FDLR fighters are the remnants of a Rwandan Hutu rebel group in the eastern DRC.
Zimbabwe is issuing a new currency known as bond notes that officially are equal to the U.S. dollar. The government has gone ahead with the plan despite warnings the new currency will fuel hyperinflation and worsen the already ailing economy. Sebastian Monfu has more from Harare.
On Monday, there were still long queues at most ATMs in Harare despite the release of the new bond notes, which are intended in part to ease the long-running cash shortages. The Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe says the new currency will, among other things, increase the country's exports. But economist Prosper Chitambara of the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe says the bond notes will worsen the country's situation.
The cost probably may even outweigh the intended benefits. Most of the economic agents in Zimbabwe, they have to buy inputs from outside our borders. So they would require either US dollars or South African rands or other internationally tradable currencies to be able to do business. Actually, the bond note is even exacerbated the macroeconomic sustainability. It has eroded confidence within the financial system. It has created a lot of uncertainties in the market. Investors are not going to be interested in doing business in Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe's economy has been struggling for nearly a generation now since President Robert Mugabe's government embarked on a controversial land reform program in 2000, which displaced white commercial farmers off their land without compensation. That affected the country's backbone agriculture. What followed were hyperinflation and shortages of almost all goods. In 2009, Zimbabwe abandoned its own worthless currency and it has been using all major foreign currencies, but mostly the US dollar. Now it has introduced bond notes despite calls to abandon the plan, as it might cause the economy to take a nosedive. That advice fell on deaf ears. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehisu Heeb, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Mired in a financial scandal for years, South African President Jacob Zuma is fighting for his political life as the ruling African National Congress Party weighs his future. Clashes between the Ugandan military and tribal militants in a remote region of the Rwenzori Mountains claims more than 55 lives. And officially equal to the US dollar, Zimbabwe is issuing a new currency known as bond notes. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
In Havana, huge crowds are mourning the death of longtime Cuban leader Fidel Castro. Castro, who was 90, died Friday after a long illness. Under his rule, Cuba played a major role in a number of African conflicts. To learn more, VOA's Joe DiCapua spoke with political science professor Muhammad El Kawas of the University of the District of Columbia.
He has really a great deal of involvement, especially with the revolutionary forces in Africa. He was very supportive of the struggle in Angola. The MPLA was a socialist group, still is. And he stood up to South Africa and the U.S. And the Soviet Union lifted the forces from Cuba, and it was able to reverse an imminent defeat by the socialist forces in Angola. He also shared whatever knowledge he has with regard to providing medical services. Cuba was far advanced in the sense that they did not have to have a degree in medicine in order to be able to treat people for minor injuries and minor illnesses. He was able to lend these experts, who did not cost too much to train, to help other countries that are facing several problems, health problems, but unable to find the decent and inexpensive treatment. So I will say that he definitely was the world revolutionary. He was able to share what he has, whatever little he has, he did in fact share. He was the leader of the non-alignment movement, and that got him to talk to other leaders in other countries, especially in Africa and the Middle East and Asia, that have similar ideologies.
So in the comments about Castro's death, the comments coming from Africa are much different than those being heard in the West.
Well, remember, most of the leaders of the era of revolutions are no longer in power or they are dead. And like somebody like Nelson Mandela, for example, somebody like NATO in Angola. So what you really have is a new leadership that has not been aware of what Castro has done because, you know, everybody is writing history books from their own perspective. And as a result, the thing is that Castro did would not go into the history books. He also put himself online to be attacked by the U.S. and other Western powers that did not appreciate him putting his nose in other countries when they wanted him to stay out. So the leadership in Africa really, as I said, is not the revolutionary crowd that came in the 1970s. Therefore, you wouldn't really have expected that you get a glowing report from Africa with regard to what Castro did, because, as I said before, history books don't mention things.
So when was the last time Cuba was involved in Africa to any great extent?
I'd say in the 70s and the 80s.
That was Professor Mohammed El-Kawas of the University of the District of Columbia. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. The Boost Africa Initiative Partnership was launched this week in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, to promote young, innovative entrepreneurs across Africa. The project is jointly run by the European Investment Bank, the African Development Bank, and the European Commission. The three partners have invested over $140 million to support over 1,500 startups across the continent. Robert Zegers, the Chief Investment Officer for the African Development Bank, spoke with me about the new integrated approach.
The initiative is unique in different manners. Firstly, we have been seeking collaborations with EIB, which we haven't had before in this extent of detail, as well as with the European Commission, which is likely to support this through their funding. And their funding is actually quite important here because it's actually leveraging our own funding because they would have a junior level in relation to our more senior financing and therefore provide a certain guarantee on our own investment, as well as investments from the European Investment Bank, which is essential because we are going to invest significant funding into early stage and startup SMEs. And as we all know, this is hugely important, but also rather risky. And that's the reason why we haven't been able to do that so far. Thanks to the unique structure of these three parties, this is the first time that this is going to allow us to actually get involved in this sector on a large scale.
Also, what types of businesses will benefit from this type of funding?
The funding is for startup SMEs as well as early stage small businesses throughout Africa that do have a degree of innovation. The innovations may often be sort of tech-based, like applications, apps that are commonly used, developed currently in Africa, and that actually assist African entrepreneurs to quickly scale up and grow. But the uniqueness is not necessarily always tech-based. It can also be other aspects that make these companies unique in terms of the delivery model or a logistical aspect or unique products or services that they have. But there must be a degree of innovation that makes them different from other companies in the sector and that allows them to quickly grow if they get the right support. And they can be throughout any of the sectors, in industries, productive sectors, or in health, in education, and other sectors, which often also have a strong social impact for the communities that they serve.
The SMEs are your small and medium enterprises. So then, would this be across Africa?
In principle, yes. As long as we have the funding available from junior tranches, as I indicated earlier, that will cover the territories in which we will do the investments, but the intention is to cover the entire Africa. Of course, our direct intervention is with funds that we carefully select and will build their capacity as well. A lot of funds will be first-time funds, so we will basically strengthen the supply side of funding for startup SMEs, but we do not engage directly with the startup SMEs. So access of SMEs will have to be through funds and to some extent through incubators that provide pipeline investee companies to funds. The SMEs that want to be assisted with funding and technical assistance need ultimately to be part of a pipeline of funds that we can support in Africa.
How will these young, innovative entrepreneurs know how to go about getting the funding?
We will work also through the lab that we're going to set up with various local entrepreneurship ecosystem players. And part of that, we will also give notifications and information to local market players, to the entrepreneurship ecosystem, including therefore to startup and early stage enterprises, to inform them of the funds that we plan to work with, so they can also actively approach local fund managers and pitch their business and to see if they can get support from those fund managers.
Why was it important for you to do this type of initiative on the continent of Africa?
Broadly speaking, the biggest opportunity and the biggest challenge at the same time lies in jobs for youth, which are not being created. And the African continent is very young. Most people in Africa are considered to be youth, and the component of youth within the broad population will only increase and will be very, very sizable in the next two decades. If we don't provide jobs for youth, this will have dire consequences. And the private sector markets are not providing those jobs currently. Currently, the public sector can't provide those jobs either. So we have to work on entrepreneurship interventions to ensure that youth have opportunities to become entrepreneurs, to create jobs for themselves and for the others that they will employ. This is very important. We have seen crises in many countries already because of youth unemployment in North Africa. The revolutions that took place there were largely because of youth unemployment-related problems, and I think we need to act now as much as we can.
Robert Zegers is the Chief Investment Officer for the African Development Bank. He spoke with me from Abidjan, Ivory Coast.
Sometimes the secret to successful conservation is taking a different approach to taking advantage of a natural resource. Rebecca Ward explains how that is working in a forest reserve in Kenya.
Charo Gumbau used to engage in illegal poaching in the Arabuko Sokoke Forest. Now, instead of a gun, he carries a net. He says that by farming butterflies, he helps reduce forest logging and destruction because he gets money from butterfly farming. Gumbau is one of the farmers for the Kapepeo Butterfly Project, which was started more than 20 years ago to help provide sustainable livelihoods in the largest remaining coastal forest in East Africa. Butterfly chrysalises are exported from Kapepeo to exhibits all over the world. Esther van der Westhuizen owns a butterfly park in South Africa.
The flight period, there where the insect has these beautiful wings, can be 4 to 14 days. So butterfly parks must get in butterflies every week.
The Kapepeo Butterfly Project now has about 300 butterfly farmers, more than a dozen of whom used to be illegal loggers. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Greenbeat.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at President Barack Obama's legacy in Africa and the U.S. Join guest host Esther Githui Ewart and her panel of guests as they take a close look at President Obama's legacy in Africa and the United States. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical journey. I guarantee.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.